Let's get together, talk about the movies that we saw this week. We'll have discussions, talk film news, we'll laugh a lot and act like geeks. Sometimes we'll have a guest or two, sometimes it's just the two of us. Let's crack some jokes and tell some folks to come along and hang with us!
Mike and Mike go to the movies. Mike and Mike go to the movies. Yeah!
You have chosen wise.
Hello and welcome to the podcast that takes place entirely inside the sunken place, Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who just can't wait to see that new Liam Neeson's movie.
What? Mike DiCruccio?
That was a Key and Peele sketch, the Liam Neeson's movie?
Oh my god. That's okay. You threw me. I was not prepared for anything, and I ruined it, so that's fine. No, let's move on.
Yeah, let's destroy my Key and Peele reference, and I resent you for it a little bit. Credit for all our theme songs goes to Kyle Cullen. If you want to contact us, you can send us an email, mikeandmikegotothemovies@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate and review the show on iTunes or Apple Podcasts if you can, since it helps people find the show and makes people feel good about ourselves when we get those good reviews. If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever we've been consuming lately. After that, we move on to our featured review. Today, that's going to be the new movie directed by Jordan Peele, Us. See, that's why I referenced Key and Peele.
Oh, before. I see.
You understand. And Get Out in the beginning, too. I wanted to
get
through the whole spectrum of Jordan Peele works.
Yes. Where's the Keanu reference?
Where is the Keanu reference? That is a good point. Okay, let's workshop the beginning of this podcast one more time.
We'll fix it in post.
We'll fix it in post, yeah. Us came out this past weekend, Mike. Huge movie at the box office. I believe the biggest opening weekend for an original movie since Avatar.
Holy shit.
Yes. So I think the Avatar opening weekend was like 79 million or something, and this was like 70 million. So like didn't surpass Avatar, but it still like came very close.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. And especially I think it's the third highest opening movie opening weekend for a horror movie ever, behind the new Halloween movie and It, both in the last couple of years. So that's pretty awesome. Jordan Peele, man. I like did not see that that career trajectory coming a few years ago.
No. No, he's got Twilight Zone coming out very soon.
Like next week?
What? Hold on.
April 1st the first two episodes hit.
I am going to be perpetually surprised this entire episode.
every bit of information that I give at you, you just got to go like, "Wait, what?" But yeah, so Us in theaters right now, we both saw it, and we're going to have some thoughts about it when we review it, and that'll be at the end of the podcast. I believe I've already explained how this works. but just in case you needed a refresher from 30 seconds ago, yes, we will do the Us review towards the end of the podcast. Right now, let's get into some film news.
Hi! It's time for...
It's time for film news here on Film Bookcast, and I'm going to begin with some pretty major news, Mike. And it's news that we sort of acknowledged on the most recent episode of Complete Works, that we kind of briefly mentioned it there. And honestly, it was so weird. This news broke just before I published our last episode of Film Bookcast. And in our last episode of Film Bookcast, I started talking about James Gunn's Suicide Squad movie, right? And how, right. Like, oh, it's a shame that James Gunn had to leave the Guardians franchise for reasons that were questionable at best, and, you know, then had to go make the Suicide Squad movie instead, and we're excited for it, but, like, it's a shame that he couldn't finish out Guardians. So we recorded that episode on, like, a Tuesday, and then the episode was published on Friday. Earlier that Friday, before the episode had published, Disney rehired James Gunn for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
You know, we just got sniped. Yeah. We just missed it.
Really, we were the victims in all this. I think Disney really has it out for us in that way. But yeah, so James Gunn is back on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Never thought I would see that coming. That is kind of insane. Like, it's crazy that Disney reversed that decision, right? Because they seem pretty adamant that they were not going to back in, like, July when this first broke. That he was being fired. So about 9 months passed. Like, it seemed like maybe James Gunn and Disney were kind of in talks, right? And it seemed like the cast of Guardians was still behind James Gunn, Drax, or Dave Bautista. who plays Drax, was very vocal about the fact that he wanted James Gunn back on the movie. But it didn't seem like Disney was budging, and it didn't seem like it was a Marvel decision. It seemed like it was much more of a Disney corporate decision. It was like Bob Iger and that whole crew. And so it just seemed like this was kind of a lost cause, and James Gunn ended up getting attached to Suicide Squad, making a movie for DC instead. And then suddenly things changed. When you saw this news, how did you react to it, Mike?
I was certainly surprised. Like, I'm definitely excited. I think James Gunn making Guardians is a good thing, coming back to finish the trilogy and all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it sort of just like all happened, I think, the same day or a couple days before around the deal with Fox was finalized.
Right.
And you're just kind of realizing like, yeah, they're going to eventually just own everything. And like, sure, why not, I guess. So James Gunn coming back, makes sense. There's one other company that he could go work for. And he's doing that also now,
yes.
So we're getting both. So that worked out.
Yeah, so what's going on now is that he's making his Suicide Squad movie, and then he's going to make his Guardians movie. They're letting him do both, which is pretty awesome. I'm actually pretty happy about that, because it's kind of I wish this whole scenario had never happened. You know, this whole thing was, like, ridiculous from the start, and it was mostly propagated by this right-wing conservative pundit, Mike Cernovich, and his kind of crew. And, like, the people who were, like, trolling and all that stuff. It was a weird internet Twitter thing that Disney reacted to very quickly. And I think I think it was right after the Roseanne Barr thing happened, right? Where she was fired.
Right in there.
And so a lot of people, like, kind of conflated the two. And, like, it really wasn't the same thing. But Disney reacted very quickly to Roseanne having, like, they fired her within, like, hours of that tweet happening that she put out. And so they kind of had the same reaction when the James Gunn thing started happening, where, like, within hours, this thing, like, they were like, all right, James Gunn's out. But because it wasn't the same situation, like, people were understandably upset about it. You know, I wish this whole situation had never happened, but now that it did happen, I feel like the best possible scenario came out of it, you know, where it's like, okay, now we're getting a Guardians 3 directed by James Gunn still, and also he's getting to make a Suicide Squad movie, which will probably be pretty good too. So like, it all worked out. And I saw somebody point out that, like, you know, the those, like, conservative pundits who tried to get rid of James Gunn, they only succeeded in giving him more work. And and that's kind of great too.
They took his one movie and made it two movies.
Plus, he
nailed it.
Plus, he probably got a payout from Disney when he was fired anyway. I mean, good for James Gunn. I'm excited. Actually, I rewatched Slither in celebration after this news broke. And I don't know if you've seen Slither in a while. Have you seen Slither?
I have seen it, but not in a long time.
Okay, that movie is still fucking awesome.
Nice.
I got the Scream Factory Blu-ray of that a while ago and opened it for the first time last weekend when I watched it, and man, it's so good. It's such a good movie. And there's a really cool, like, half hour interview with James Gunn just in the making of Slither, and he kind of contextualizes it within the realm of his Guardians of the Galaxy movies, and it's pretty cool.
Nice.
But yeah, so happy to have James Gunn back in Guardians 3. News that we never saw coming, but we're pretty stoked about. And then Marvel also hired another director for one of their upcoming movies, Shang-Chi, which will be their first movie with an Asian lead. Destin Daniel Cretton is going to be the director of that movie. He was the director of Short Term 12, which is a movie that I feel like has been talked about a lot lately.
Yeah, I feel like that has come up. I know I haven't seen it yet, but I know it stars a lot, or features at least, a lot of actors that have made it to the big leagues now.
Absolutely. I mean, it stars Brie Larson, who is Captain Marvel now. It stars Keith Stanfield, who ended up being a big deal with Sorry to Bother You in Atlanta. Rami Malek's in that movie. Stephanie Beatrice from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, also in that movie, and this is, like, before any of them were really famous. I mean, Brie Larson had been in a couple things, like, she had been in Scott Pilgrim and 21 Jump Street at this point, but, like, this was her first kind of, like, big leading role. It was a pretty huge indie movie when it came out. Like, it was very widely critically acclaimed. I saw it when it came out, have not seen it since, but I remember liking it a lot. And so Destin Daniel Cretton, who directed Short Term 12, attached to make Shang-Chi, not the name that, like, I would think that I would think of for a character like Shang-Chi, which is this martial arts based character. There's nothing in Short Term 12 that makes me think, like, yeah, this guy could do a martial arts movie. and then he also did a movie, I think it was called, like, Glass Castle or something. It also starred Brie Larson and Woody Harrelson, I think. I didn't see that one. I heard that was, like, kind of more mixed than Short Term 12 was. But, Marvel has been kind of doing this thing where they're taking small-scale indie directors and putting them on their movies at this point. They did the same thing with Captain Marvel with Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. So I guess we'll see how this turns out. I think with the right action department, Shang-Chi should be pretty awesome.
Right. Yeah, that was your big complaint or gripe, at least, whatever you want to say, about Captain Marvel.
Right.
Was the character moments, the small moments that fit this kind of like indie drama stuff were great, but the larger action set pieces felt a little flat. So
yes, I would say that. And I think with Shang-Chi, I feel like the action needs to be awesome. It's a martial arts character. Like, it needs to be fantastic.
Yeah,
for this movie to work. So yes, yeah, so we'll see how that goes. But that is the next Marvel director to be snapped up by Disney.
Yep.
Basically, like you were saying, there's like two companies that people can work for now. because yeah, and we didn't really reference this that much, but there was like a sort of conspiracy theory that I kind of saw where it's like, you know, maybe Disney never really fired James Gunn, but like they kind
right.
like they fired him, but only because the Fox deal hadn't gone through yet at the time. And now that the Fox deal has gone through, they were like, hey, let's bring James Gunn back, everybody.
Yeah, let's get a huge bump in goodwill again.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, bring him back.
So it was a little fishy that it happened so soon around the Fox deal. Like, I think when they got rid of him, they wanted there to be no controversy surrounding Disney at all, so that there was no bumps in the road to getting that deal closed. Now that it's closed, they can bring it back and it's fine.
Right.
So yeah, and the Fox deal, I mean, we've been pretty vocal about it, saying like, yeah, this is not good. Like, it's not a good thing for the entertainment industry as a whole, or really how we consume entertainment, because it's going to really homogenize, I think, a lot of things. And a lot of the focus online has been around, but what if these X-Men join the Avengers? And like, that's and like, that's some of that is fun to think about. Like, I am intrigued and excited about some of those prospects. But there's a larger picture here that is that's not great. I think we've referenced this in the past, but in the novel Cloud Atlas, there was like a thing in that book where it's in the future, like hundreds of years in the future, or whatever, and all movies are referred to as Disney's because Disney is the only one making movies.
Yep.
And we're getting dangerously close to that reality.
Yeah, like we said, I think I probably said it in the Captain Marvel episode, that we live in a hellscape of late-stage capitalism. So
yes.
There we go. That's the new motto of the podcast.
Exactly. All right, let's move on from that news, Mike. Let's talk about a director who I think we're both big fans of, Christopher Nolan.
Who? Wait, what?
Are you in character as Guy Pearce from Memento? Because you can't remember who he is? Is that what it is?
I'm that one guy from Jaws. That's confused about what a tiger shark is.
A tiger shark? What? Yeah, no. So Christopher Nolan has scheduled his next movie with WB, and they're giving him his prime release date, July 2020. That's always his thing. Almost every Christopher Nolan movie has come out in July 2020, actually. Or not, in July.
Wait. What kind of interstellar, like, time is relative Tesseract bullshit are you pulling?
Yeah, no, just July, not in July 2020. That is the twist, is that they all came out in 2020. Most of them come out in July. I think pretty much since The Dark Knight. It's like The Dark Knight, Inception, Dark Knight Rises. Interstellar came out in November, but then Dunkirk was back in July. Like, they all come out like the same weekend in July. And now his next movie, same deal, July 2020. We know almost nothing about it, but it might be inspired by Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest, which, like, Nolan's take on that, I think, could be really cool. We do know a couple of people who have been cast in the movie, and so I kind of wanted to just briefly mention that Nolan's cast for this movie is pretty awesome. You've got John David Washington, who is the star of Black Klansman and the son of Denzel Washington. Robert Pattinson is going to be in this movie, which I think, if you haven't been following his career lately, might be a surprise. But if you have been following his career lately, then that's very, very exciting, because he makes a lot of really cool indie movies. And Elizabeth Debicki, who has been crushing it in a bunch of different things, like Widows and Guardians 2 and Man from U.N.C.L.E. and a whole bunch of cool stuff.
Yeah, I think that Nolan doing North by Northwest with that cast is enough to make me like see it. I'm in.
Yes, yeah, that's awesome. Again, we don't know anything else about this movie. We don't know who else will be cast in the movie. I'm guessing Michael Caine's a safe bet. Cillian Murphy, Tom Hardy, the usual Nolan crew.
Which, like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm all about that. But, yeah, so that's really all we know. So I kind of want to just briefly mention that casting has happened, and there will be some more casting, and hopefully, like, an actual description of what the movie is in the near future. And then want to jump over to some DC news real quick, Mike, and talk about The Flash, which is a movie that will never be made.
But wait a second.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that The Flash won't happen, but Ezra Miller, who is still attached to star as the Flash in this movie, who played him in Justice League, is apparently writing his own script for the movie now, with Grant Morrison, the comic book writer. And apparently he might leave the project if it doesn't get used.
Okay. See you later, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. Like, right now, Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daley, who are the directors of Game Night, are attached to Make the Flash. They're attached to direct the movie. And I believe they wrote their own script. And so I guess there's some kind of creative difference thing going on where, you know, they have their own script. Ezra Miller isn't super happy with it. So now he's writing his own script. And so now there's these two competing scripts. And if they don't use Ezra Miller's script, he might leave. But if they do use his script, I'm guessing that John Francis Daley and Jonathan Goldstein might leave.
Now, if I say I wrote a script with Grant Morrison, right?
Yes.
I wonder how much of that script is actually me and how much of that is the world-renowned comic book writer Grant Morrison.
Good point. Yes, that's definitely that's a good point. It's probably largely Grant Morrison writing that script. Yeah. That's like with Ben Affleck and Matt Damon writing Good Will Hunting, and there were the jokes about how it's like Matt Damon actually writing it and Ben Affleck just kind of like on the couch, like just kind of twirling a ball around.
Yeah, exactly. He just was in the room.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, as far as The Flash goes, this is a movie that I've long felt we do not need because there was a Flash TV show on right now, and it's pretty much, like, it's not a perfect show, and I think it was a really good show at one point, and it's still a pretty good show. As far as The Flash goes, it's like, I don't really need any other version of The Flash right now. Like, The Flash TV show has got me covered.
Yeah. That said, Ezra Miller's Flash in Justice League was, like, a lot of fun. Like, I was kind of into it.
Yeah, he was solid in Justice League, but I also remember feeling that way about Jason Momoa's Aquaman in Justice League, and I wasn't the biggest fan of his Aquaman in Aquaman.
That's fair.
So we'll see. I will say that, you know, Shazam's coming out in, like, a week or two, and they had, like, an early fan screening, like, Fandango did, like, a screening last weekend or whatever, and our friend Kyle, who did the theme songs for the show, went to that screening, and he said it was really good, and I've heard good things from non-Kyle people as well. So it is confirmed. Like, Shazam is supposedly pretty fun, and I think we'll be reviewing that one on the next episode of Film Bookcast. And I'm kind of about it. I think Shazam looks like a lot of fun. And I think if The Flash could tap into the tone they seem to be going for Shazam, like, it could be pretty cool. But I just don't know if this thing... It seems like this project has cycled through so many different directors and writers. I remember, I think they wanted Robert Zemeckis to make it at one point. They had the guy who made Dope to this at one point. And they had, like, there's so many different... There's been, like, four or five directors on the Flash movie, and none of them have panned out. And there's been so many different screenplay drafts, and none of them have panned out. So I don't think this movie will get made anytime soon.
It'll come out when the Black Cat Silver Sable movie comes out.
Honestly, I think that movie is more likely to happen than the Flash movie. Only because, like, Sony's going full steam ahead in their Morbius movie. Like, that's coming
out
next
year. That's true, yeah.
And if they're making a Morbius movie, then Black Cat Silver Sable has got to be on the docket, you know?
Right? Like, that seems like an easier sell than Morbius.
I think it is. I mean, at least Morbius you can sell, like, on the as, like, a vampire horror movie, right?
Yeah, that's true.
But Black Cat is a known character. Like, not as known as, like, Venom, but, like, a pretty well-known character. And you can say, like, hey, it's knockoff Catwoman. We can sell this.
Yeah, it's a heist movie. Like, I'm in.
So, so honestly, I think Black Cat Silver Sable might have a better chance of being made than The Flash, which is insane to think about. But that is the year 2019 that we're living in.
Yep.
Anyway, let's move on from the Flash news and get into probably the most exciting news outside of the James Gunn stuff. Bill and Ted 3, baby! It's
most exciting specifically for you.
Yes, I'm a huge Bill and Ted fan. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, both perfect movies. And Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter released a video together this past week where they officially announced Bill and Ted 3. This has been in the works for a very long time. I've heard about what the script would be, and it sounds very exciting. And so they did this announcement video where they said, like, yeah, we're doing Bill and Ted 3, Wild Stallions are back, and they announced a release date of August 21st, 2020, so next year. And actually today the news broke that William Sadler will be back reprising his role as Death from Bogus Journey, which is awesome. And I felt like he had to be there because Death is the bass player of Wild Stallions at the end of at the end of Bogus Journey, so of course he's there. But I think this movie really has, like, a cool opportunity to show what Bill and Ted have been up to, like kind of examine middle age and what that means for characters like Bill and Ted, and
Right.
That's kind of what it sounds like the script will be. The movie's called Bill and Ted Face the Music.
What a great, like, great name.
And it does, like, involve time travel in some capacity, probably, and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, it's going to be awesome. And you have not seen either of the Bill and Teds, right, Mike?
No. Mm-hmm. I'll put them on my queue.
You got to fix that, because we are reviewing this movie when it comes out. and by reviewing,
right, I got a year then.
And by reviewing, I mean, I'm going to geek out about it for like an hour and a half.
Okay.
And you can sit there silently if you want.
I'll chime in every now and then.
I just wanted to kind of give a shout out to Bill and Ted 3 because that's awesome. Just super excited about it. And then finally, one last bit of news. And I kind of want to just briefly mention this because this show meant a lot to me. Richard Erdman, who played Leonard on Community, passed away at the age of 93. And Leonard was one of my favorite recurring characters on Community. There was a recurring joke on that show, Shut Up Leonard. Then they would have like some weird quip, like those girls you were playing ping pong with were doing it ironically and that kind of thing.
All hail Sir Eats Alone.
Shut up, Leonard. I heard about your prescription socks.
I'm always willing to go the extra mile to avoid doing something.
Like sex with women.
Shut up, Leonard. You smell like mentholyptus. What are you even doing here?
The stakes have never been higher.
Shut up, Leonard. I found your YouTube page. What's the point in reviewing frozen pizza?
You're talking about it.
Well, that is true.
Hello, everyone. Shirley asked me to say something nice at her wedding.
This is the rehearsal.
Shut up, Leonard. Those teenage girls you play ping pong with are doing it ironically.
Well, why are you trying to take this away from me? I like having no anxiety. I'm in harmony with the world.
Looking good, Winger.
Thank you, Leonard, for that compliment and for your service to this country.
So he's finally going to let me practice my psych skills on him. Give me some credit, Winger. What's the worst that could happen?
Classic tee-up.
Shut up, Leonard. I know about your crooked wang.
No such thing as bad press.
And that kind of thing. But Leonard was always hilarious, and I want to just give a shout-out to Richard Erdman, who was great on that show and was there through all six seasons. But it was also like a longtime character actor who was in so many things over the course of like decades of stuff. He's probably best known, outside of Leonard, for his famous episode of The Twilight Zone, actually. Where he's the main character in A Kind of Stopwatch, which is the one where a main character gets a watch that can stop time and then breaks at the end.
Yes,
That is Leonard from Community in the lead as the main character of that episode. I think that's pretty awesome.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Dan Harmon on his Instagram shared a pretty funny story about him where I think it was the first – he didn't know who it was. He just – it was like a casting call for like, 80s white – Willing to Swim or something like that was the character. And he showed up and he was like giving him a direction or whatever. And Harmon was giving him a direction and he just responded with like a fart noise. And he was like, what? Like, he didn't know what to do. And he was like, okay, let's just like try it. And then whatever. And like our PA or somebody on the set was like, dude, look at his IMDb. And it's like, holy shit, what have I done? Like, he had no idea that this guy had been acting for like 70 years or whatever it was.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool.
Yeah, and the fart noise became a key part of Leonard's character as well.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there. There's the pretty great episode of Community where it ends with a debate between Leonard and Magnitude, and it's just Leonard going, and Magnitude going, pop, pop, and just back and forth. And it's great. So anyway, RIP Richard Erdman. I was very saddened to hear that news. Let's move on into our discussions, Mike, starting right now.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here in Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today on a film book first, I have a lot of discussions, Mike.
Actually, way more discussions than I have. Which is also a film book first.
How the turntables, you know?
The shoe is on the other table, which is turned.
So first things up, I want to talk about Eli Roth's History of Horror. This is now currently available on Shudder. I think it had aired on AMC, which owns Shudder, in October, like during the Halloween season. And it's pretty cool. It's just like seven episodes or something like that, where each episode deals with a different genre of horror. So, you know, one episode, zombie movies, and he just has like a panel of people. It's a bunch of interviews with, you know, Greg Nicotero and Rob Zombie, Quentin Tarantino, and like a bunch of pretty cool people.
Yeah.
That are just film, a lot of film scholars, some, the editor in chief of Fangoria. Like, there's a lot of people like that. And they just talk about deep dive kind of on each genre. The only thing that's kind of weird, there's a few moments that feel real like circle jerky. Cause like it's AMC, right? And on the zombie one, they talk about The Walking Dead a lot.
I'm sure,
like,
yeah.
You know, like, that's kind of weird. And like, and the, it's like, there's a lot of interesting stuff. Like when they deep dive, when they do deep dive, like, you know, Joe Dante shows up when they talk about creature features. So we could talk about Gremlins. Like, that's a lot of fun. Like, that kind of stuff is cool. But it does, a lot of times they sort of just talk about the most obvious movies, you know, like,
right.
It's not, it's less of a history, quote unquote, and more just, we like talking about movies, and I happen to also enjoy that, so I like had fun. There's a couple times where they do like give historical context, like they talk about, particularly the slashers is two episodes. There's two whole episodes dedicated to slashers, which is pretty cool. But they talk about torture porn, right? Like that kind of new most recent genre of that kind of movie.
I mean, there's nobody better to talk about torture porn than Eli Roth, I think, actually.
Right. But like, it becomes self-serving a little bit because he's like, we kind of coined that, and it's like, well, it's kind of weird. But in that segment, they talk about contextualizing it. Those movies, Saw, Hostel, and like that kind of stuff, came out around the time like the U.S. was being revealed to be torturing people, like in the war and terrorism and all this stuff. So like that kind of stuff I was really liking. I thought that was a lot of fun, or not fun, but very interesting.
Yeah.
But then to put it side by side where like, okay, we're just gonna have Rob Zombie talk about how he likes, you know, whatever scene in Dawn of the Dead, which like is also fun, but I wish it had done more of that contextualization stuff, because I thought I was scratching that itch every now and then when you want that stuff.
Gotcha.
So that's History of Horror. That's available on Shudder right now.
Yeah, I remember. I think AMC also did like a sci-fi version of that too. With James Cameron. Like, it was a James Cameron's like History of Sci-Fi type thing.
Oh, that's cool. I feel like I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't watch that, but I heard about it. It sounded pretty cool, and I think it might also be on Shudder. I'm not 100% on that, but I feel like I've seen it. If not on Shudder, then it's like somewhere. It's on some kind of streaming service right now.
Yeah.
And I know that doesn't narrow it down at all, but it might be on Shudder.
Yeah. Some of the stuff with the History of Horror, real quick. Like, some of the gets are kind of cool. Like, I can't remember the guy's name, but he's the guy that did all the effects for George Romero's movies. So, like, in that episode, they're talking to him. And it's cool. Like, that's part of the whole shtick of zombie movies, right?
Is that Tom Savini? Is that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, to hear his story, like, some of his stories are, like, we would just go up to George and ask him, like, can we put a screwdriver in that guy's ear? And he's like, yeah, sure. And they would go figure out how to do it. Like, you know, stuff like that. Like, if you're into that kind of stuff, this is pretty cool.
Nice.
So then the next thing I want to talk about is Don't Answer the Phone.
Run if you must.
Hello, operator. It's an emergency. Can you help me?
Hide if you can. Scream if you are able.
Who's there?
But above all, if you are alone, don't answer the phone.
This is a 1980s serial killer movie, I guess.
Okay.
It's like a strangler movie kind of thing.
Yeah. This is one of your Vinegar Syndrome discs?
Yes. Yeah. Vinegar Syndrome, a boutique Blu-ray publisher. I don't know what those, distributor, what are those called? I don't really know.
Whatever. They sell Blu-rays.
They sell Blu-rays, yeah. They go out and find kind of cults, forgotten movies, restore them into Blu-ray, do all these special feature things.
Yeah.
And this is just like a real sleazy, like, 1980 L.A. underground, underbelly criminal exploitation movie, right? And it's a lot of fun. It's bad. Like, it's goofy. Like, the guy, I didn't write the actor's name, who's like the killer. He's just on 11, and like, no, everyone else is in a comedy and he's on 11 in his horror movie. And it's so funny, to see those together. You know, the two detectives are just like scumbags.
Yeah.
They're going to like a brothel and they're like, we don't care about the vice here. And like, we're homicide. And they're like, they think they're all badasses and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's fun. This would be a good movie to see like in one of these kind of horror movie marathon things we go to. I think this would be a lot of fun with a big audience of people just like hamming it up with this movie. So that's Don't Answer the Phone. Next one is Eye of the Needle from 1981. starring Donald Sutherland. Ooh. And talk about Whiplash from Don't Answer the Phone. This is a based on a novel by Ken Follett, I think, is the author that wrote Pillars of the World, Pillars of the Earth, actually. And it's a World War II spy espionage thriller. Donald Sutherland plays a British officer who's revealed in the first 5 minutes, like, it's not a spoiler, that he's a, like, Nazi spy in 1944 England. Yeah, and it's just this, like, really slow burn, tense espionage thriller where he is trying to meet the U-boat that will bring him back to Germany after, like, now that his mission has ended.
Yeah.
And just that, like, race against time. The British officer's trying to catch him and the family he becomes entwined with and all this stuff. And it's really weird. This is a movie that my parents reference, like, my whole life.
Really?
Which is bizarre, yeah. Yeah, because his code name is Needle in the movie. Like, that's the whole Eye of the Needle, right?
Yeah.
And they're constantly saying it with a German accent, so they keep saying, like, Noddle, which is very, it's just, like, goofy. And my parents have said that my whole life. They've said Noddle like that.
Really?
Yeah, it's bizarre. There's a couple movies like that. Like, honestly, Gaslighting, before it has become, like, this cultural phenomenon, like, actual accepted term. My parents used to say it because, you know, based on the movie, they would reference the movie for it. So, yeah, it's super weird. But this movie came up on the Pure Cinema podcast, which we're both big fans of.
Yep.
And I was like, I guess I gotta watch it if it's getting brought up on something like that. Apparently, it's like a real actual movie and my parents aren't just like being nerds. So I watched Eye of the Needle. It definitely, you know, it's from 1981. It is, like, kind of slow. Like, you know, it has that early, you know, 1980, like, that era espionage thriller thing where it's, like, kind of slow. A lot of character acting and, like, character development. But it's cool. Like, it explodes into, like, you know, some real action at the end. So
cool.
Definitely check that one out.
Nice.
And speaking of movies that follow that formula, I have two S. Craig Zahler movies.
All right.
First, yes, director of Brawl in Cell Block 99, which we saw, I think, last year that came out.
That was a 2017 movie.
Oh.
But it came out, like, the very end of 2017, and so I didn't see it until, like, early 2018. Then I think I made you, like, I was like, you gotta watch this movie, and so you watched it too.
Yeah, I know you, I think you used it as a discussion on here once.
I think so, and then it became, like, it is, like, you know, I watched it after we recorded our top 10 episode that year, but it is my number one movie of 2017.
Wow.
I am a huge fan of Brawl in Cell Block 99. That movie's insane.
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. So, S. Craig Zahler has a new movie out right now called Dragged Across Concrete.
You're losing perspective and compassion. There's a reason I'm sitting behind this desk running things. And you're out there with a partner that's 20 years younger than you.
Hey, Anthony's got a mouth with his own engine, but he's solid.
I'm thinking about the kind of future I can offer my girlfriend.
Pops is a yesterday who ain't worth worrying.
Good heavens and praise be to him.
Your absence was a weight upon us.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonton.
I don't like doing things with so many question marks everywhere.
There's a lot of imbeciles out there.
Yes, and I wanted to see this. It came out on VOD this past weekend. And I wanted to watch it, and I will get around to it, but it's like 2 hours and 45 minutes.
And
I was like, I just didn't have the time. But apparently you did, so...
Yeah. It's, you know, it's tough. This movie is apparently playing in, like, 25 theaters in the whole country, and one of them is in Manhattan. And I was like, oh, man, I was so close to getting to see it. Just timing didn't work out in a theater. So I got to watch it on Amazon instead. It's, like, $7 or something to rent.
Okay.
And, man, you know, I really wanted to go. I think I really did like Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. But Dragged Across Concrete takes this very... Well, first off, it stars Vince Vaughn again, which is awesome. But it also stars Mel Gibson, which...
Yes, yeah.
It's controversial on its own level, right? Like, whatever. But this movie is a 2 hour and 45 minute exploration of what happens to two police officers that get caught on, like, cell phone video assaulting a person they're arresting, basically.
Okay.
Right? And they get suspended. And they, like, you know, we have to provide for our family, like, all this stuff. Yeah. But it becomes very macho, conservative, hardline, just right-wing. Like, it's blatantly racist, but these Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn are racist characters, and I can't tell where it comes down on condemning or condoning them. Yeah. And Zoller has come out and said, like, oh, I don't make films that express values, which, like, fuck you, man. That's not possible. Your political beliefs influence literally everything you do, whether you know it or not. And I think saying that you made something apolitical is, like, just a total fucking bad take. You just missed the point. Or you are so privileged that you don't realize that there are politics involved in what you did, because it doesn't affect you. So, that said, like, there are some cool things, there are some interesting stuff. It has, you know, Zoller's brutal ultraviolence that is present in Brawl in Cell Block 99. But it feels less effective in this one, in Dragged Across Concrete. Like, in Brawl, it's not really there, I don't think, until the last act, basically, right?
Right. I mean, there's definitely, like, there's bursts of violence in Brawl. Right. Yeah. But it is a very slow burn. Then by the time you get to the end, it's like, holy fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. It goes nuts. And the problem with Dragged Across Concrete is it has that, but it's always at that last act level, right? Like, there's just graphic violence, but like a half hour apart every time, because this movie is so fucking long. If this was a 2-hour movie, I might have enjoyed it more. Yeah. But it's just so slow, and a lot of it is just them, like, on a stakeout, and it's just them sitting there eating food, and we're just listening to them eating.
Yeah.
For, like, I don't know, more than 20 seconds, which is basically all you can take of that, right? Like, imagine just sitting there, someone listening, crinkling aluminum foil and chewing. Like, that's what we're doing for a couple minutes. And there's some moments where we just go aside to learn about this new character that just got introduced to provide a full backstory for them to be brutally dead in 7 minutes. And it's like, we could have cut out the whole backstory part. You know, like, it feels like it kind of meanders and stuff. It's just, I don't know, man. I don't think I liked it, which is really unfortunate because I really like Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
Or Brawl in Cell Block 99. And I just don't think I can look past the casual racism. And, like, and they, like, directly reference what happened with Mel Gibson.
Do they really?
Yeah. Like, okay. They get caught on the cell phone video. And this is also, like, within the first 5-10 minutes. And Don Johnson is back, who I think he was the warden, right? In
Brawl,
Cell?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, he's like a police chief guy.
I was looking at the cast list for this movie, and they're like, everybody who is in Brawl and Cell Block 99 is in this
movie.
Is
back.
Jennifer Carpenter's in this, right? And Udo Kier, right? Yep.
Yeah, and Michael Jai White, who was Spawn, is in this.
Oh, yes.
Which is kind of cool.
Yes, and Black Dynamite.
Yeah, that's right. Right, so like they get caught on the video, and there's a moment where Don Johnson's talking to them, and he's like, you know, being branded a racist in today's climate is akin to being called a communist in the 1950s. And then we, like, have a beat, and he's like, whether it's being caught on the phone using an epithet in a conversation, in a private conversation, which, like, that's what happened to Mel Gibson, or being mishandling a minority during an arrest. And it's like, well, fuck, you can't ever claim that this is an apolitical movie if you're going to do that. Like, fuck off, man.
Yeah.
So,
I will say, I mean, I still want to see Dragged Across Concrete because I was such a big fan of Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
And I liked his first movie, Bone Tomahawk, quite a bit, too. But I think, you know, the way you talk about it, like, the kind of conservative right-wing bent that this movie has, I think that stuff is present in his other movies. Like, if you watch Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99, there is that kind of... They kind of become this, like right-wing fantasy movies in a weird way. And I think that this movie might have exemplified that more, possibly because the casting of Mel Gibson exemplifies that more. And I think people... Like, as more and more people are seeing his movies, I've seen more and more people on Twitter and stuff like that, film critics, kind of raise the same concerns that you've had with this movie.
Yeah.
But I've also seen, like, positive takes in the movie. I've seen some other stuff where it's, like, it's sort of a takedown of that kind of thing. But it's a weird situation where it's, like, I remember when The Wolf of Wall Street came out, a lot of people were, like, this movie's, like, endorsing Jordan Belfort. But it's, like, it was trying to present his actions in a way that, you know, it sort of makes it seem fun and, like, that's kind of Scorsese Goodfellas type way, but then kind of tear it all down and being, like, no, this is bad. And it sounds like Dragged Across Concrete might be trying to do that too, in a certain way, but maybe not as successfully.
I think I would have given it the benefit of the doubt, right? And said, like, yes, you know, things don't work out quite the way they plan in this movie, right? Like, you know, maybe they get their comeuppance. If Zoller hadn't said that he made is attempting to not express values in his movie and like thinks this is apolitical and whatever you project onto it is your own. And it's like, fuck no, man. Like, if you have Mel Gibson in a movie about a racist guy and you address what happened to Mel Gibson, like, that's not it's unavoidable, I think.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I don't really remember that stuff in Brawl in Cell Block 99. And maybe it's, you know, a product of 2019, where we are right now in the world, that these kind of things, this might have slipped under the radar in that, or, you know, that respect, if this had come out 3 years ago or 2 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do remember, like, you know, I remember in Cell Block 99, he's kind of, like, Vince Vaughn's character is a bad guy, but, like, stuff happened. Like, I don't remember that specific, like, hardline right conservative stuff. But that brings me to my next movie, yes. My next discussion. Right after I finished right after I finished Dragged Across Concrete, I was like, oh, I haven't seen Bone Tomahawk. It's free on Amazon. I got to watch it right now.
So after you saw this movie and thoroughly did not enjoy it, you were like, I got to watch the first one.
I got to watch the 2-hour and 15-minute version instead of 2-hour and 45-minute version.
Yeah.
Yes. And you know what's crazy? I fucking loved Bone Tomahawk. This movie is insane. It's amazing.
Yes.
And I wonder how much of it is because it dives so hard into the genre of Western exploitation film. Like, Dragged Across Concrete is just kind of like a slow, slow burn cop drama.
Okay. And so you're saying maybe Dragged Across Concrete is like too close to the real world as it is right now.
Yes.
Whereas, you know, Brawl in Cell Block 99 is like this throwback exploitation prison movie, and Bone Tomahawk is this like kind of Western horror film. So
yeah.
going deeper into the genre maybe helps it out in some way.
Yeah, I don't know if it allows Zoller to work with tropes in a different way or in expectations, rather than it just be, like you said, I think, for me, Dragged Across Concrete doesn't hit all that stuff. It's not enough of a fantastical setting for me to be able to have that one step of removal from, you know, its apolitics, quote-unquote.
Yes.
But Bone Tomahawk, you know, Kurt Russell, Richard Jenkins, Matthew Fox, and Patrick Wilson.
Yeah.
And Lily Simmons is, like, the wife that gets kidnapped, which, you know, that is a trope, you know. this movie is, like, this weird, like, spaghetti Western exploitation horror monster movie thing going on. Like, it touches on so much stuff.
Yeah.
And it, of course, you know, is the macho man, like, Western frontier man stuff. But I feel like maybe, I think in Bone Tomahawk, it kind of addresses these problems head on and, like, sort of, I think, deals with them and kind of tears them down in some way, right? Like, there are African-American characters in this movie set in 1890 or whatever it's supposed to be, and they're not, like, just slaves or you know, played that way. They are just, like, living in this town, working here.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, you know, reference that, like, that historical context that a lot of these people, you know, far right or conservative people like to say, like, oh, it's just realism, man. And it's like, no, you can choose not to put that stuff in your movie. And Zoller chooses not to in Bone Tomahawk, which I think is an interesting. It's interesting to watch this after Dragged Across Concrete and see, like, you ended up at that movie. Like, it's like the radicalization of Zoller, maybe. I don't know. And, you know, Lily Simmons at one point, like, criticizes, like, this is why life on the frontier is hard, because you're fucking idiots. Like, you do everything wrong because you're idiots. And it's like, wow, that's like an empowering moment for a female character in a movie set in 1980. Or 1890.
1980.
And also in a movie set in 1980. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like he's kind of tearing down some of that stuff, and he doesn't in Dragged Across Concrete. But that said, Bone Tomahawk is fucking dope. Like, graphic violence, which is always fun. The creatures, right? They're monsters. Like, the Native American characters are called savage by the other Native American character. Like, it's super weird to do. So, like, that aspect of it is definitely problematic, but, like, it's super effective. Like, they have weird bones and stuff, and they, like, don't talk and shit.
Also has one of the, I think it might have the most brutal kill I've ever seen in a movie. In Bone Tomahawk.
the splitting scene, and we won't say more than that, I guess.
No.
So be ready. Definitely, none of his movies are for the faint of heart or weak of stomach. Everything is very graphic. So those are my discussions.
Okay, interesting. You had a lot to say about Dragged Across Concrete and Bone Tomahawk. And I still do want to see Dragged Across Concrete. We'll probably do that within the next few weeks, and I'll kind of come back to that in discussions and see what I think. But I was such a huge fan of Bone Tomahawk and Brawl in Cell Block 99.
Yeah.
And this one, it's like, I still want to see it. The casting of Mel Gibson made me a little wary of it when it was first announced. And now it's out, and the reviews have been decidedly more mixed than the first two movies. So I'm going in with, like, tempered expectations, and also with the understanding that it's fucking 2 hours and 45 minutes, and, like, it's probably doesn't need to be.
I think that's the, like, big thing, too. Like, yeah. And also, like, sitting at home on your couch for 2 hours and 45 minutes to watch a movie you're not that engaged in is fucking hard, man.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, so those are your discussions, Mike. I have a few that I wanted to get to as well. Less than you do, only three movies this time around. So it's How the Mighty Have Fallen, I know.
Yes.
So I wanted to first mention this new movie, a new documentary called Apollo 11, which is directed by Todd Douglas Miller, actually a documentary developed for CNN. But it's playing in theaters right now, and it was able to. I saw it at the Roxy right near my house. And it's a new documentary detailing the journey of Apollo 11 in the days leading up to the launch all the way to its landing back on Earth. From the first moon landing. And it's assembled almost entirely from this unearthed, like, never-been-made-public footage, much of it filmed in 70mm, and, like, beautifully restored. Yeah, so they had this, like, 70mm film just that was just going while they were making this thing. While they were
burning money.
While they were building this rocket ship, they were like, you know what, let's hire fucking... Who's the guy who made Lawrence of Arabia? Get him in here. And we'll... David Lean, you're up. No, I mean, they were already hiring Stanley Kubrick anyway, right? So
yeah, he could have done it.
But anyway, a lot of it was filmed, like, a lot of this footage is, like, 70mm footage. It's never been made public before. It was kind of recently unearthed. They restored it, and they kind of edited it together to kind of tell the story of, you know, the days leading up to the launch, then the actual launch, the landing on the moon, and then the coming back. And it kind of honestly reminded me a little bit of They Shall Not Grow Old, which is the new World War I documentary Peter Jackson made, which is kind of the same thing. It takes this, like, old stock footage, restores it, and kind of turns it into the story, and it's entirely told through the footage and through, like, old voiceover. Like, there's no, like, narration, there's no talking head interviews or anything like that. It's just kind of presenting the footage to you with the archival voiceover and, like, things like that kind of playing overhead. The editing is amazing. I think the score is fantastic. And at its best moments, it makes you feel like you're right alongside Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, like, as they make their way to the moon. There's this one incredible shot where it's just the camera on, like, the bottom of the lunar lander as it's landing on the moon. And it just holds that. Like, it shows you, like, that entire journey from, like, 200,000 feet up all the way to the bottom or something. And it's, like, you're kind of watching that. And it's, like, a 5-minute, like, shot where you're just watching that landing on the moon, and it's so tense and so cool, and it's really cool. If you're into history, if you're into the space program, this is, like, definitely something to check out, and worth seeing on the big screen if you can. Like, I think watching it on CNN, like, I'm sure it will air on CNN in a few months. Like, that's usually how these kind of documentaries go. Like, I know, like, there's, like, PBS documentaries that air in theaters, then they go on PBS, like, 3 months later or something. Right. Like, so you can watch it on TV later, I'm sure, but if you can see it in a theater, like, do it. It's an experience. And I think it's also a really good companion piece to First Man, which came out last year, which kind of, I mean, that's obviously a biopic starring Ryan Gosling as Neil Armstrong. And that kind of takes a more, like, emotional look at, like, Neil Armstrong's journey to the moon. Whereas this is much more like a scientific, like, just these are the events that happened as they happened kind of thing. And here's how they dealt with all these problems. Like, it's a much more scientific movie than First Man. So if you watch, like, First Man, you get the emotional journey. And in this one, you get the actual, like, nuts and bolts of how it happened. So it's pretty cool. So that's Apollo 11, and it's a new documentary available to watch. I don't know if it's still in theaters, but it is available to watch right now. And then want to go some throwback horror myself. You know, there's a new Pet Sematary remake coming out.
Yes.
I think next week, actually. I think it comes out the same weekend as Shazam. I was not looking forward to the Pet Sematary remake. I thought the trailers looked like they were fine, like, whatever. I wasn't, like, super into them. And then I have not read the book. But I know, based on, like, comments on the trailers and stuff, from the trailers it was made clear that there are significant changes that this movie, the remake, has made to the original book. And, you know, people who are, like, book purists were not happy about it or whatever. So it wasn't really on my radar that much. I probably would have seen it because I see everything, but, like, I wasn't, like, that [S2] Right. [S1] Excited about it. But then reviews started coming out of South by Southwest. It had its premiere there. And it turns out, most of the reviews for the new Pet Sematary were, like, really good. Apparently, it's, like, really solid, very scary. And it does change a lot of things from Stephen King's book, but it does them in interesting ways. And, like, it has, like, a whole new take on the whole concept. And so, apparently, the new Pet Sematary is supposed to be really good, and I'm much more excited about it now. And when those reviews started coming out, I was like, you know what? I've never actually seen the original Pet Sematary from 1989. So I was like, hey, I'll watch that.
There you go.
And it's available right now on Amazon Prime and also on Hulu. Directed by Mary Lambert, who I'm not sure what else she's made, but I know. But it's very rare for a female horror director to be a thing in the 80s.
Yeah.
So for Pet Sematary to have a woman director is kind of cool. But anyway, yeah, this movie came out in 89. It has a theme song from the Ramones.
Fuck yeah.
So, like, I'm already in. Like, I had heard the Ramones song. That's, like, my entire knowledge of Pet Sematary was just based on the Ramones theme song. In the night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't want to be buried in a Pet Sematary. I don't want to live my life again. That's all it was. But yeah, so I wanted to watch this before the remake came out. And I think the original is, like, solid. Like, I've heard people say, like, the original's not very good. I thought it was, like, you know, some campy fun. It's not, like, super scary, but it's very 80s. Things go, like, kind of bug nuts crazy towards the end. And it has, like, a lot of, like, there's a lot of scenes in it that actually reminded me of An American Werewolf in London. You know the bits in American Werewolf where, like, the best friend is, like, just, like, dead and, like, decaying in the corner.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of that going on in this movie where, like, yep. There's, like, a guy who's, like, trying to help them, but he's like a corpse that's just kind of following them around. And
He was, like, a jogger or something, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Have you seen the original Pet Sematary?
Yes, and I've also read the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I don't really remember a whole lot about the book, but I do remember this, like, one experience. Well, not whatever. Experience is, like, makes it sound too strong. But I think it must have been, like, 8th grade. Or maybe 7th grade or something. I remember the summer reading was The Outsiders, right? Like, that's the book I was reading at the time. Well, I was supposed to be reading at the time. And I was like, ah, fuck this. I'm going to pick up. My mom has, all of Stephen King's books, right? We have a huge, like, bookshelf.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm picking this one. I picked Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
And I started to read it, and I was too scared. I typically read before I go to bed. I was too scared to read Pet Sematary at night. So I had to start reading The Outsiders because that was my nighttime book and Pet Sematary was my daytime book. I couldn't read them. I couldn't read Pet Sematary at night. Yeah, so I do remember that, like, jogger that was hit by a van or some shit.
Yes.
Right? I think is the thing, which I wonder what that is, Stephen King, who was hit by a van, P.S., in case you didn't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. anyway, yeah. I have seen the original one. I just remember, is it Fred... Gwynn?
Fred Gwynn as the old man who used to be he was Herman Munster on the Munsters.
Right.
He's amazing in this movie. He's great.
Yeah, just him yelling, like, sometimes dead is better, but with, like, his weird accent or whatever.
Yes, and John Lithgow plays that character in the new movie.
Can't wait.
And I am into, like, if you watch the trailers, like, it always ends with him saying, sometimes dead is better, and that kind of thing. So, like, it's very cool. It's very, like, kind of a creepy, like, tagline. And, I'm pretty excited about that new movie, actually, now. Like, the reviews have been good, and I watched the original, and it was pretty good. And now, like, I kind of know the story, so I'm very curious to see how this movie changes some of that stuff. Because the original movie, as far as I know, is a relatively faithful adaptation of the novel Pet Sematary. Like, I'm sure there's stuff they change.
Yeah.
But like, this new one, it sounds like they really changed. There's, like, one major change that happens halfway through, and I shouldn't say, like, it's in the trailer. So, and it's only really a spoiler, like, if you know what happens in the book. I'll talk about it off air.
Okay. Yeah. I don't really remember, so.
Yeah. Have you seen the trailer for the new Pet Sematary?
I have seen it, yeah.
Okay. I remember when every time I saw the trailer for Pet Sematary, I would always confuse it with the trailer for Us. During its first shot, because it's the first shot of both trailers is, like, the family of four driving in a car in the woods. And and every time, like, the trailer would start, I was like, oh, hey, it's Us. And it's like, nope, it's Pet Sematary. And then every time I was like, oh, hey, it's Pet Sematary. Nope, it's Us. I was like, God damn it.
Yeah, the once the music starts, you're like, oh, wait, no, it's the other one.
Yeah. And it's weird they're both coming out, like, within, like, 2 weeks of each other, too.
Yeah.
So I don't even have time to enjoy the fact that there's only one trailer it can be. for the foreseeable future. Anyway, that is the original Pet Sematary. I really dug it. Available on Amazon Prime if you want to refresh yourself before going to see the new one. And then finally got one more here. This movie called Persepolis, which, have you ever seen Persepolis, Mike?
I have not, but I heard of it. I know what it is.
Yeah, I had not seen Persepolis, but this is an animated movie from 2007, directed by Marjan Satrapi and Vincent Parunad. It was actually nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars that year, lost to Ratatouille.
Jesus.
I mean, Ratatouille is a really good movie, too. Like, I'm not gonna...
Oh, yeah, but I was just thinking, like, the subject matter of... it can't be more different.
Yes, no, definitely. But anyway, so Persepolis is this movie set in 1970s Iran, depicting the life of a young girl kind of growing up during the Iranian Revolution. And that sounds very bleak and and depressing. it is that. Like, it definitely is that partially. But it's also... the movie has this, like, really amazing sense of humor that I was not expecting. And, you know, it speaks very honestly about just the universal experience of growing up and finding yourself. Like, at points, it kind of plays like something like eighth grade, you know, and that kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, I loved this movie. I thought it was great. It was playing at the Roxy. They're doing this Women's March series this month. So for the entire month of March, because it's Women's History Month, they're showing movies that are directed by women or featuring women in prominent roles and that kind of thing. And so Persepolis is one of the movies they're showing. And yeah, it's awesome. It's based on a graphic novel by Marjan Satrapi, who co-directed the movie also. And the main character is wonderful. It's kind of like an autobiographical thing. There's an Eye of the Tiger needle drop that is just super delightful. And you know, I had a really good time with this movie. Like, it's often very emotional and like stressful. But at the same time, like, there's this really human element underneath, and it's very funny. And I really dug it. So Persepolis. Probably my favorite of the movies I'm talking about today, honestly, like of these three discussions. Like, I was like, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So that is my that's my discussions for the day, Mike. And I think now we can move on into our review of Us.
Can't believe how big Dave got.
Did you hear Gabe got a boat?
He's kidding, right?
He's not kidding.
Hey, I think it's vodka o'clock.
Oh, yeah.
Where's Jason?
Jason!
Where were you?
I didn't know if you were lost. Stick with me, and I'll keep you safe.
There's a family in our driveway.
It's probably the neighbors.
But y'all scared of a family?
Hi, can I help you?
Zora, put your shoes on.
If you want to get crazy, we can get crazy. What are you people?
It's Us.
All right, that was from the trailer for Us, the new movie written and directed by Jordan Peele. It stars Lupita Nyong'o, Winston Duke, Shahadi Wright Joseph, Evan Alex, Elizabeth Moss, and Tim Heidecker, among others. Which, by the way, the fact that Tim Heidecker is in this movie, awesome. Just
yeah, insane.
Yeah, that was great. The IMDb plot synopsis for Us reads, "A family's serenity turns to chaos when a group of doppelgangers begins to terrorize them." So, Mike, we were both big fans of Get Out.
Yes.
And you named Get Out your number one movie of 2017, back when we did that episode. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, sure. That certainly sounds like a thing I would have done.
Yes, way back in the day, you named Get Out your number one movie of the year. So yeah, I think we were both definitely pretty excited about Jordan Peele's next movie, which is Us.
Yeah, yeah. I was so hyped for this movie, especially just like when the when the trailer dropped, but like just hearing about what it was going to be and stuff,
yes.
It just sounds, the concept for this movie is incredible.
Yeah. So, let's hear your take on it, Mike. What did you think of, Jordan Peele's Us?
I love that Jordan Peele is tricking people into seeing art house horror films. He's like, the first two thirds of this movie are a just creepy horror movie. And then twist. I have something very important to say. and it's amazing. I was like hooked, absolutely hooked with, you know, the first half of this movie, at least. Yeah. The second half, or, you know, or back, the last act or whatever, got like it got crazy, and I loved that it just was like, you know, we always talk about this too. Just we're gonna swing for the fences, and I don't know if this movie quite sticks it, but the fact that he did this, that Jordan Peele even did this story and told it the way he did, yes, is like outrageous and amazing. And he is just such a like craftsman. And it's for a second movie, like we saw it in Get Out, right? Like that movie is beautifully arranged and shot and everything, and this movie is also like that. It's incredible that he's just like, ah, yeah, I can do it, and it's fucking awesome.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I wanted to rewatch Get Out before I saw Us, actually, just because I haven't seen it since it was in theaters, and I have the Blu-ray. Like, I've had the Blu-ray for like over a year, and I have not rewatched it yet. It's just been sitting there on my shelf. So at some point, I'm going to rewatch Get Out. But I will say, I really enjoyed Us. I thought Us was very good. I think Jordan Peele has a more than proven himself in the realm of horror movie making at this point. Yeah. I think Us lets him allows him to get loose a lot more than Get Out did.
Right.
You know, I think it's a bigger, like more ambitious follow up that is a little messier, right? And I think it's a little more all over the place than Get Out was. I think Get Out was like just so perfectly focused on what it wanted to be.
Right.
Whereas this feels like it's a little more all over the place, but it all works, I think, because Jordan Peele directs the hell out of it. And there's no shortage of like really inspired sequences. There's a lot of like really great sequences. I'm just like, man, that was amazing. And also the performers are like really incredibly committed to the concept, especially Lupita Nyong'o, who crushes it in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't wait for her to be snubbed at the Oscars this year.
She's this year's Toni Collette.
Yep. The exact same thought. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I saw somebody online, I think it was Bob Chipman, the movie Bob on YouTube. He had this, he posted this on Twitter, this idea that Nyong'o's performance may be one of the best horror performances of all time, for this reason. You know, if you think about it, like Jamie Lee Curtis might be great as Laurie Strode in the new Halloween, right? But she only has to play Laurie Strode in that movie.
Yeah.
Whereas Nyong'o is playing both Laurie Strode and Michael Myers.
Wow.
And crushing it in both roles. Like, I think she's doing a great job.
That's amazing. I wouldn't have never thought of it that way, and that's exactly what it is. That's incredible.
Yeah, so, and Us, I think the thing about Us, and I'm curious, if you actually bought tickets for this movie accidentally, so you're going to see it again on Thursday, right?
Yeah, coming up, yeah, in a few days.
So you accidentally bought tickets to see this movie twice, but I will say, I think that might be the best way to see the movie. Like, I'm kind of mad at myself that I couldn't see it twice before we did this podcast.
Yeah, yeah. So I originally, there's a series apparently at the Alma Draft House, at least the one in Brooklyn. That's like somebody puts it on every month or something like that.
Yeah.
And the way they phrased the announcement was like, "Join us to see Jordan Peele's Us," you know, in theater with conversation to follow or something like that. And I thought it meant Jordan Peele was going to be there and would do a Q&A after. And I was like, oh my God, yes. And I immediately bought a ticket. And then I actually read the thing and it was like, oh no, it's just like whatever this movie series is. And also it's after we record the podcast. So I guess I need to see it anyway. But yeah, like I'm hyped. Like my original plan was I'll see it, you know, for this. And then if I like it, I'll just go to the movie a second time. And if not, I'll just refund it. But like, I think this is the best, you have to see this movie twice, I think.
Yeah. That's sort of how I felt. So I think I'm going to try to go again this weekend. If I can, but yeah, just, it feels like a movie that I need to see again, because there's so much here that works and it goes places like I did not expect it to go. And by the time the story gets to where it's going, it feels like it recontextualizes everything else in the movie, to the point where like a second viewing, I think, will feel completely different from the first. It kind of feels like when you watch The Sixth Sense, right?
Right.
And you watch The Sixth Sense for the first time, and let's say you don't know that Bruce Willis is dead the whole time, because when,
what?
Spoilers, I guess, for The Sixth Sense. But when you watch The Sixth Sense, like when you were in the theater back in 99, and I saw the movie when I was like 8 and I didn't know the twist, you know, when that happened. Because I was like, right, that was like a year or two after the movie had come out. You know, when you watch The Sixth Sense, you don't know that Bruce Willis is dead the whole time. And, you know, there's clues throughout the movie that hint towards that. But like the big reveal at the end where it's like, holy shit, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time. This changes the entire movie. And then when you go back and watch the movie again, you're watching it from the perspective of somebody who knows that Bruce Willis is dead the whole time. And so you can pick up on things, you see different clues, and like the movie plays entirely differently from that viewing forward. Right. And I think Us is a movie in that same vein.
Yeah, there is so much just going on, like within the movie, with what's being said and what's not being said and all this stuff. It's just movie. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting comparison or companion piece to Get Out. Like you said, it's so much more ambitious. Get Out, it's like laser focused on what it's saying. And yeah. This is it's very strongly saying something. I'm not, but I love that it's open ended, right? Like you can't really miss the point of Get Out. But for us, I wouldn't say you can miss the point. I think we can all come to our own different conclusion, which is incredible.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more open to interpretation than Get Out is.
Yeah.
I will say, I think the first act, as it's starting off, I feel like it takes a little long to get to where it's going. Or at least that's how I felt in the first viewing. I feel like when I watch it again the second time, I might not be so sure about that, because I feel like there is a lot of stuff in the first act planting the seeds for what happens later in the movie. And actually, even like when I was watching the movie, I was like, the first act does set up a lot of stuff that like just pays off in small ways throughout. Once the shit hits the fan, though, like once all that stuff, once the doppelgangers show up, the movie's a blast. Like it kind of just ratchets up the intensity and the insanity, and you know, the action sequences and the horror sequences, like they're all really solid.
Yeah, the whole second act of this movie is like one of the best horror movies of the last couple of years. It's amazing. The whole home invasion sequence is top-notch horror for this decade, I would say.
Yeah, and during that home invasion sequence, I was thinking to myself, like, is this... I thought the home invasion sequence was going to be the whole movie. Kind of from that point forward, I was like, oh, yeah, because it seemed like it was taking... Like, you spent a lot of time in that home invasion sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like that was going to be it. And I think that would have been fine, you know. But the movie goes much, much further than that. With the concept and with like everything going on, and I can't really say any more than that without delving into spoilers. But suffice to say, the home invasion is not the movie. It's a good chunk of the movie, but it's not the movie.
Yeah, it's a delivery device for the rest of the point of the movie. could you imagine? Like, I don't know if I would have been disappointed if this was the follow up and it was just like a creepy home invasion movie,
right?
Like, it's follow up to Get Out, which had such a pointed view. I think I might have been let down if it doesn't have that third act. And I don't know how successful the third act is, but I don't know if it necessarily needs to be perfect, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I sort of see what you're saying. Like, you kind of admire the audacity of what he's going for.
Yeah.
More than if he actually is successful in achieving it. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I don't know if the fact that he tries to do what he does seems more important than perfectly articulating the point, if that makes sense.
Sure. I think he's thrown a lot of ideas on the table in this movie. And really most of those ideas kind of come to the forefront probably around the halfway point of the movie.
Yes.
That's when they really start to pile up. And, you know, again, a lot of it's open to interpretation. Some of it's very blunt. Some of it's very subtle. And there's just a lot of different things happening. And again, we can't really delve into that until we get into spoilers, so we'll talk about that in a few minutes, I guess. But I want to, you know, give one more shout-out to Lupita Nyong'o, who's great in this movie, and everyone's been heaping praise on Lupita Nyong'o. But I also want to give equal praise to Shahadi Wright Joseph, actually, as the daughter, who I thought was amazing. I thought she was incredible in this movie. Her doppelganger and, like, her creepy smile was, like, a highlight of the movie for me. Just like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. The son was great, and even though I know you hate kid actors, like, he did amazing.
Yeah, he was good. He was solid.
Yeah, Winston Duke, like, what a blast. What a fucking dweeb.
Winston Duke and Tim Heidecker get like these dopey husband roles, and they have a lot of fun with them. They're great.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't realize that that's Tim from, like, Tim and Eric's awesome show, Good Job.
You didn't realize that?
No, I didn't know it was his last name, and I was looking at him, and I was like, that dude looks really familiar. Like, okay, whatever. And then I listened to, I think, the Slash Filmcast, and they were like, oh my god, Tim Heidecker's in this movie. And I was like, all right, I gotta Google it. And I was like, holy shit, Tim Heidecker's in this movie? Like, it makes so much sense now.
Yeah, this could be doing Tim and Eric's actual billion-dollar movie.
Yeah, right?
But yeah, Tim Heidecker's here. Also, Elizabeth Moss plays his wife, and she's a lot of fun, too, in this movie, I think, as well. And the score for this movie. I mean, Michael Abels did the score for this movie, and I think it's really great, appropriately very creepy. Just that one, like, sting that goes like... Doo-doo!
Yeah. Like, you know.
It's just really good. One. You know, that perfectly recreated musical sting that I just did. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I got it.
But yeah, I think us, honestly, you know, it's so weird that Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone premieres next week. This feels like a great pilot episode for... for it Jordan really Peele's Twilight does. Zone.
Yeah. I hyped about that. But I just, like, wasn't really sure what to make about the Twilight Zone, but now I'm fucking on board, man.
Right. Yes. Yeah, they put out, I think the first two episodes premiere on April 1st or something. And I'm probably going to wait until they're all out and just, like, kind of do the free trial of CBS All Access and binge them or something.
Yeah.
But the first, they put out trailers for the first two episodes, and they look really cool, dude. Nice. They look really cool. Like, Jordan Peele's doing the Rod Serling thing. One of them's got Camille Nanjiani. The other one's got Adam Scott. I'm pretty excited about it. All right. So I think we've kind of talked about all we can talk about with us without getting into spoiler territory. So I think maybe we should just move on to spoilers, Mike. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
any last thoughts before we move on?
Just like what an incredibly ambitious follow up to Get Out. And, I applaud it heavily for that. And it's fucking terrifying. It's like a really good horror movie for most of it. It's awesome.
All right, cool. So yeah, let's move on to the spoilers for us starting right now. All right, spoilers for us starting right now. Hey, Mike, this week I watched a film in which Elizabeth Moss plays her own doppelganger in a story about a couple being terrorized by mirror versions of themselves that ends with the wife character probably not being the person you thought she was this whole time.
What?
But enough about the one I love, Mike.
Got it. Yeah? Boom.
That's a joke for, like, you exclusively, I think.
Yeah. Wait, did nobody see that movie? I don't remember.
The one I love was not a big movie when it came out. Man. And it should have been. If everybody should go watch The One I Love right now. It's an amazing movie. I know I just spoiled it for you.
But we are in spoilers, to be fair.
We are in spoiler territory for us, I guess. But yeah, The One I Love with Elizabeth Moss and Mark Duplass. Fantastic movie. My favorite movie of 2014, actually. And this movie sort of has some similarities with that movie. It has the doppelganger concept, and Elizabeth Moss is in it, and those are the two things. So,
you know, the stuff you already talked about.
Yeah. So, Mike, we should talk about the big twist in this movie, which is that Lupita Nyong'o's character was one of the tethered the whole time.
Right.
So that she actually, like, the movie begins with this flashback in 1986, which, by the way, they mentioned they're on the Santa Cruz boardwalk, and there's like a throwaway line of dialogue where they mentioned, like, there's a movie filming over that way right now. And the movie that was filming on the Santa Cruz boardwalk in 1986 was The Lost Boys, which came out in 87.
Wow.
Just throwing that out there. But anyway, so you start off in this, prologue in 1986, where, you see this young version of Lupita Nyong'o's character, Adelaide, and she's kind of like with her family and she wanders off on her own. And she ends up in this like kind of fun house hall of mirrors and she's walking through and it's creepy and you know, something's going to happen. And like, I that's also in the trailer. Like, you've seen bits like of that in the trailer. So you kind of know something like, you know, like bad shit's about to go down.
Yeah.
And she runs into like another version of herself, and that's where you see the doppelganger for the first time. And when it's presented to you in the beginning of the movie, it just makes it seem like she like kind of just runs the fuck away, gets back to her family, and that's the end of that. And she just knows she doesn't want to come back to that hall of mirrors because she doesn't want to confront that fear, she repressed that memory and everything like that. Right. At the end of the movie, it's revealed that no, actually, that doppelganger fucking knocked out young Lupita Nyong'o. Dragged her down into like the terror dome that they live in, and kind of forced her to live among the tethered while she took her place. And so the Lupita Nyong'o you have been watching the entire movie was actually one of the tethered the whole time. Do I have that? There's, I feel like I had to explain a lot in order to get to that point, but it's like I have that all right, right?
Yes, you do. Yeah.
So what did you think of this whole twist, Mike?
That twist lands for me, but it like you said, it recontextualizes the whole movie, and I'm like sort of thinking about it now in the like from that point of view, and it, like, holy shit. But it does this thing where, you know, it's the last, you know, 30 seconds of the movie explain the twist, like the twist happens and the movie ends, and it's like, oh man, what is that world now? I'm like, my mind is gone. Yeah, I loved it. It makes the kind of statement of the movie or the question mark of the movie or whatever you want to call it so much louder. I don't like there's already so much going on at that point in this movie, like, holy shit, what's happening? And then also this, and like, oh my god, I feel like this is where the sort of like muddled message comes from a little bit, but like,
yeah,
just like from a storytelling point, I thought it works really well and I really enjoyed it. But then you add that next layer of like critique or whatever you want to call it. And it makes that a little more muddled, that layer, this twist. But, you know, from a storytelling point of view, I really liked it.
Yeah, definitely. I thought the big twist worked a lot. I think it really works. And it does force you to reconsider what you thought was good and what you thought was evil throughout the entire movie, because the real Adelaide is the one who was terrorizing the family this whole time. And so the Tethered exist as like this shadow version of their human counterparts, and they live like nightmare versions of their own lives underground. You see glimpses of that where you see a person kind of doing their whole thing above ground, and then you see them underground, and it's like, oh, just wandering around like aimlessly kind of thing, but doing the same things that the upstairs people are doing. And you know, that the real Adelaide, I guess, becomes a Tethered. It's very weird to explain, but I guess if you're above ground, you are in control, is basically my guess. Because the way it seemed to work is that like the above ground, like Red is the doppelganger's name, by the way. All the doppelgangers have names, even though none of them are used in the movie, I don't think, as far as I know.
No.
Yeah. So, but for our purposes, Red is the Tethered Adelaide, who you actually were watching the whole movie, and Adelaide is the young girl who was kidnapped and lived among the Tethered for like 30 years.
Right.
And I don't even know where I was going with that.
Well, and this is like I've heard, you know, the guys in the Celestial cast kind of talk about this, where like the movie never takes the time to explain the rules of what's going on, so it makes it that much more confusing. It's another layer of confusing on it. Like, we don't know which one, because you know, the Tethered, Lupita Nyong'o explains that they were created in order to control the people on the surface in some kind of like they live situation, right?
By the government.
The government created them to control the people on the surface, and then they were abandoned. And now it seems like the people on the surface control the people under the Tethered. So like, it feels weird. But I don't know if it necessarily needs to be a crystal clear set of rules about which is which and how that works and stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it needed to be either. But the movie, like, I think does like a half-hearted attempt to make that explanation too, which is also part of the thing. So when you get down there and you see like Lupita Nyong'o versus Lupita Nyong'o, and you see the like original Adelaide, and you don't know this at the time that she's the original yet. But she's like in a classroom, and she's kind of like drawing the Hands Across America thing on the chalkboard. And she basically explains to her, a lot of what you're seeing. Right. Yeah. So she's explaining what the Tethered actually are, and like why these tunnels exist and all that stuff. And, you know, everything about that third act is bonkers, but that sequence sort of reminded me of Interstellar in a way, specifically in the way where like, you know, and I love Interstellar, but like, you know the scene in Interstellar where like the big kind of twist is happening, and Matthew McConaughey's floating through space, and he's going through space time, and it's amazing. But at the same time, he's also explaining everything that's happening while it's happening. Like, he's just like talking and monologuing for like five straight minutes, and it's like, this would be better if you weren't talking. You know, like I am super into everything going on around right now, but this is really like a show don't tell type situation. And I think if this movie had just shown that stuff with no explanation, had like, you know, the tunnels and the rabbits and the, you know, all that stuff, and just left like, you know, visual clues here and there about what was going on, I think that might have helped that land better for me, because then you don't have like, then you could just kind of create your own theories out of it. Right. I think if you had treated it like Twin Peaks, right, where it's like, there's no explanation for why like the Red Room exists, right? The Black Lodge exists. They just do. Right.
Yeah.
Like this, that might have been the better way to go around it. But because it kind of pays lip service to explaining some stuff in that scene, but not everything, then it's like, well, now I need more explained.
Yeah. Pictured while you were talking about that with Interstellar, you know, like the last 20 minutes of 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
I just pictured that with Matthew McConaughey narrating what's going on over it. And it's the funniest thing, because that's what happens, basically. Like,
pretty much, yeah.
Just do it and fucking go for it without telling me what's going on. Yeah, I kind of agree. I feel like it sort of hints at, like, a mythos or you know, mythology, rather, and, like, explains what's going on. And I kind of loved what's going on, like, that sequence, even though it feels very much we need to just explain my idea because it's weird.
Yeah.
But, like, the kind of montage of them showing young Adelaide, well, actually, that might be at the very end, where she remembers, where we see, like, them walking through like the amusement park and then the tethered doing it and like up going up and down and the dance sequence where we're seeing them both dancing at the same time. Like some of that is crazy and like beautiful and like scary and like just like on an existential level. I also forgot where I was going. This movie is so confusing.
There's a lot of layers to try to keep track of in this movie. Yeah. But I think ultimately, you know, why the twist works. It does, like I was saying, it makes you reconsider what you thought was good versus what you thought was evil. Because the tethered, you know, they exist in this like weird nightmare version of reality. And they're brought to the brink of insanity just by nature of their circumstances. Like, I think by having the person you're watching, Lupita Nyong'o, actually be a tethered the entire time, it kind of changes your entire perception of what the tethered can be. They are forced to, like, and then you have the actual Adelaide being kind of gone native or whatever, gone insane among the tethered.
Yeah.
Because they've been forced into that. That's the circumstances of their situation. And I think it sort of becomes like a sort of haves versus have-nots kind of scenario. Like you know, like what you kind of see in real life all the time, where like, you know, people who are born into poverty or stuff like that, they can't really get out of that in any, every one in a million can, but like it's very difficult. And that's kind of the case here, where like one of them was able to get out of that, that took their chance to improve their station in life, but it forced Adelaide to live down there as well. And so you kind of have dual perspectives, if that makes sense, which is the whole point of this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that sort of becomes the main thesis of the movie is that, you know, given, you know, like you said, given the opportunity and privilege that everyone else is given, these tethered, you know, insert whatever other category you want in society, in real life, given the same privilege as those above, can thrive, would succeed at what they're doing and would become a well-adjusted, you know, quote, whatever that means. You know, well-to-do family, well-to-do person, like, you know, I can't think of the productive member of society. There we go. That's the phrase I was looking for. Given the chance, if not locked in a basement in these underground tunnels, just the key forgotten about by the government. Like, that's the most on the nose thing ever. which I loved though. Like it's very effective. Yes. I keep forgetting what I'm saying.
In conclusion, yes.
But also, us.
I think there's all... What were you going to say, Mike?
I was going to say, I have to go. My people need me.
In conclusion, us is a land of contrast. I think there's also something to be said about how the tethered kind of... Like, I saw this kind of theory floating around. I think it was in the comment section on Birth, Movies, Death or something. But I did like it, where it's like the tethered kind of appear to sort of represent a person's repressed dreams in some way. Like throughout the movie, you know, Lupita Nyong'o towards the beginning mentions that she wanted to be a dancer, right? And she kind of quit that at some point. But then that kind of comes back later on, where like the real Adelaide is actually like a great dancer. Like that's kind of like a big thing of what's going on in that final climax. But then on top of that, you have Zora talking about how she's thinking of quitting track at the beginning of the movie, right? But then tethered Zora is like a track superstar. She's super fast, like the running is and everything. And there's a bit where Jason can't get his lighter to work, like at the beginning of the movie. Mm-hmm. And tethered Jason is surrounded by fire and half his face is burned and that kind of thing. So I think there's like, it's interesting to see like these people's kind of hopes and dreams. They sort of come to pass in certain ways in the tethered world. Under the surface, it's like they repress that in the real world, and then it kind of gets pushed into their repressed selves in the tethered world, like kind of pushed down.
Yeah, yeah, that was the dance specifically with Adelaide's dance, Adelaide and Red's dance, was the one part that I was like, I wanted explained more or shown more, because that's the moment, according to the exposition dump, where the tethered realized that Red/Adelaide was going to be the one to save them, right? She says, like, that's when they saw God or something like that. Like, it becomes very, you know, biblical and stuff, which is kind of cool and offset or off-putting. But at that point, I couldn't figure out, you know, we don't know that she's actually the tethered on the surface world yet. At that point in the movie. Yes. So it's like, is that when they realize they can control them? Like, you know, like I wish that was explained a little bit more because like you said, we're in the middle of a giant exposition dump explaining stuff. but it is cool. Like from a creepy, weird storytelling point of view.
Right. I do keep coming back to, Lupita's line when the tethered first show up in their house, which is a great sequence. Like, they're just standing there in the driveway for a long time. And Winston Duke's like, so it's sort of played for laughs at first, right? Where Winston's like, you want to get crazy? We can get crazy and that kind of thing. And, like, he's bringing the bat out. But then, you know, they just kind of, as soon as they scatter in the driveway, you're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, that was terrifying.
And so when they finally, like, they get the family, like, all kind of trapped in the house, and Lupita Nyong'o starts talking, and it's, like, this, like, raspy, like, slow, terrifying voice that she's using.
Yeah.
And then you realize, and the other tethereds aren't doing that. Like, they're just kind of, like, talking in, like, weird guttural sounds, like, what they have to communicate to each other. So, like, that's an early sign that, like, that Lupita might be the real Adelaide in some case, but you don't really think about that when you're watching it then.
No.
But I keep coming back to the lines she has when they ask her, like, what are you? And she says, like, we are Americans.
Yeah.
and that's like, you know, it's, I think there's a lot you can read into that line. And I think this might be a stretch, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. You know, when Get Out came out, I think part of the reason that movie was huge is because it was this really interesting racial commentary so soon after the 2016 election, where Donald Trump just took office, right? Like, the inauguration was like 2 months before that. And so that was like a matter of, like, you know, mostly coincidence. Like, I think Trump and all that kind of stuff was probably on Jordan Peele's mind while he was writing the movie. But I mean, the movie was in production well before, like, all that stuff had gotten down.
Yeah.
With us, like, we are now living in sort of a post-Trump world. And I feel like the concept of the tethereds almost feels like Jordan Peele's take on Trump supporters in a weird way. Like, if they're all dressed in red, which is one thing, but you know, they're people who feel like the government didn't represent them or had abandoned them in some way, and so they're lashing out in violent ways.
Right.
And I think at the very least, I think the idea of there being, like, quote unquote, like, two Americas is one that is very much explored here, and I think that's best exemplified by the final shot where all the tethereds are doing the hands across America thing, which, like, hey, happens to look like a wall. dividing the screen in half.
Yeah, you know? No, absolutely. I don't think that's on accident. And I don't know, like, and that's what I was sort of referencing, or the possibility of that being the kind of thesis of the movie, too. Like, this movie is so open-ended and open to interpretation that, like, is an absolutely valid thing, like, takeaway. But I was, like, I'm just thinking now of that scene, that conversation they're having in, like, in front of the fireplace or whatever, with the tethered and the family, when Lupita Nyong'o is explaining, like, what happens. Like, the girl, you know, she's, like, saying, oh, the girl meets a man and falls in love and has a son or whatever. Like, she's, like, explaining, like, her history to her and is using the language of, like, as a tethered, saying, and the girl has a shadow, right? And the shadow is forced to be with this man, and the shadow is forced to have these children, which now, in the context of being, knowing that she's the real Adelaide and has been literally knocked unconscious and put down there, like, she is actually literally forced to go through these things because she's been swapped. It's like, holy shit, that's blowing my mind.
Definitely. And I think, you know, I want to come back to the Hands Across America thing for a bit, because that feels significant too. Like, that's, I mean, that's such a huge part of the movie. And it feels like, you know, part of it is a thing that Lupita Nyong'o remembers from childhood, right? And that's part of it too, where it's like, you see, like, the original Adelaide watching the Hands Across America tape or the commercial, whatever, when she's a kid. And she has, like, the Hands Across America t-shirt and stuff like that when she ends up down there. And so it becomes a thing that she remembers from childhood that she kind of, like, latches onto, and it becomes, like, a symbol of what the tethered do throughout the movie. Like, they do the kind of linked hands across the world. And Hands Across America was this event where people linked hands in an effort to fight world hunger, but it was, like, ultimately a pretty hollow event. If you actually, like, read into the history of Hands Across America, like, it raised, like, $35 million, but, like, 2/3 of that had to go towards the cost of just putting on the event itself.
Jesus Christ.
And the promotions and stuff. Like, it kind of, like, significantly backfired. And so it sort of feels like a twisted take on that in some respect, where it's like the government doing a stupid thing and, like, all that kind of thing. And it's like, I don't know. I think there's a lot to read into the Hands Across America thing, and I'm not smart enough to get into all of it.
Yeah.
But it feels significant.
Yeah. I think it definitely plays upon the fact that it was effectively a pointless gesture, right? Where that's what they do. You know, you said they didn't really raise any money for it. I think, was it homelessness, or you said world hunger? I can't remember.
I think it was world hunger. Yeah.
World hunger. Yeah. Where that's the thing that young Adelaide latches onto, and effectively, when they do that, when the tethered do that, it's not going to affect the change they want, right? Like, you just came up and murdered presumably thousands of people, right? Like, you just completely destroyed the country, possibly, which also, you know, that might be another thing in yeah. favor of the, it could be the Republicans, or Trump supporters at least, and build this wall or, you know, form this chain or whatever. And I think, I don't know, I think there's a lot to unpack there too. But I think ultimately it comes down to not being a real thing. Like, just like it was the first time, it's going to end up not affecting the change they expect to affect, at least. A lot going on here. I feel like in a couple of years we're going to see, like, entire doctorates written just about this one movie.
Yeah, I mean, because it throws so many ideas out there, which is impressive. And I think the fact that, like, this movie was so successful... is pretty exciting, I think, for this kind of horror with a message to kind of get out there too. And there's plenty of horror movies that have like that kind of thing, like a message to go along with them, or they do like social satire and that kind of thing. I mean, George Romero was doing that for 50 years,
right? But... Which actually they sort of talk about that in the back to the history of horror thing real quick, where like the slasher movies in the 80s were like sort of just espousing like Reagan family values, right? Like Reagan era family values, like the teenagers that have sex and drink die and the virgin right. lives. Like, I feel like that's present in everything. Like, refer back to my other discussion. And it's crazy that Peele and like this movie opens with like actually opens with this, like, the text about like underground tunnels, which,
oh yes,
yeah, like the miles of abandoned tunnels throughout the world or throughout the country and stuff like that, which like immediately evokes like Underground Railroad. And
that's what I thought too. I thought this movie was going to go in like Underground Railroad type direction.
Yeah, which I mean, it's I guess not really doesn't quite go there, but definitely affects that, right? Or
yeah, evokes that image when that text comes up. It definitely evokes that image. And yeah, I don't know. It's just especially like I remember when that text came up, I was like, huh. Like, I didn't see anything in the trailers about underground tunnels.
Interesting.
But then the tunnels don't even come into play until, like, you're 80% of the way through the movie at that point. Like, and so I had forgotten about the text with the tunnels when they came in. And I was like, oh, like, that's why they had that. All right.
Well, you know, it's weird. So you follow that scene, that moment, right, the text is followed by the shot of the TV playing the commercial for...
Hands
Across America. And there's a lot of VHS cassettes. Cassettes? Tapes? Whatever. I don't know what they call cassettes. I don't know. That's the music.
Either one's fine. Yes, either one's fine.
next to the TV. And the only one that I managed to read, I don't know if it's like the theater I went to was very dark or something. I couldn't, like, the first moment where I was like, do I need glasses? Like, what's happening? The only one I could read was Chud, the title, right. Which is like cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers or something like that.
Right.
Which I was like, what? So we just had a thing about underground tunnels, and Chud is very prominently displayed, and I was like, it immediately put me in that mindset, which, like,
yes.
And you picked up another thing about that, right? With the
So there are a few VHS tapes there, and yes, Chud is a pretty prominent probably the biggest foreshadowing of the movie is the fact that Chud is sitting there.
Yeah, which I loved
on the display. And there's a couple of the VHSs. There's a VHS of The Right Stuff there, and I honestly think like every single one of those movies that is there is probably there for a reason. Like, it doesn't seem like it's, you know, it's any accident or whatever. I don't know why The Right Stuff was there. I would have to go back. Although it's weird because there was a VHS tape of The Right Stuff in Captain Marvel also. In the
that one makes sense because it's like space guys.
Right, exactly. But it's weird that there's like two movies within like 2 weeks of each other that both have VHS tapes of The Right Stuff prominently featured. But in that scene, there's a VHS tape of The Goonies. And so you see that VHS tape of The Goonies, and I caught that right away, and I was like, "Hey, The Goonies, cool." Because maybe this is just me. Whenever there is like a bunch of movies like prominently displayed in a scene, my eye is drawn to see what movies they are. In that scene in Captain Marvel when like she's walking through Blockbuster, I was like, "Hey, the Hudsucker Proxy is like over there in the background. That's cool."
Nice. Yeah.
So my eyes get drawn to that kind of stuff, and so I saw that The Goonies was on the shelf. I was like, "Hey, The Goonies, cool." And then I didn't think anything of it because, like, oh yeah, it's The Goonies, like whatever. and then towards the end of the movie, when the real Adelaide, but you don't know that yet, the real Adelaide is doing that big exposition dump during the chalkboard scene. She's talking about how they've always wanted to reach the surface, and then she says something to the effect of like, "It's our time. It's our time up there." And it's like, and that's a line from The Goonies. That's, or it's a variation of a line from The Goonies. Like, it's like Mikey says, like, "It's our time down here," and that kind of thing, right?
Right.
And so she says that, and I was like, "Hey, that must be why The Goonies was the beginning of the movie," right? Like, my mind immediately went to The Goonies. I was like, "Hey, they showed The Goonies VHS tape. She just quoted The Goonies. Like, cool. Like, that's basically all I thought about. And then the twist was revealed, right? Where it's like, she was the real Adelaide the whole time. And then you realize that the real Adelaide, like, she wasn't just, like, saying a line that was also in the Goonies. She was directly quoting the Goonies because she remembers it from her childhood. That's, like, a childhood memory for her of watching the Goonies on that VHS tape back home in 1986.
Wham. Cut to black, roll credits. Yeah. Like,
and like I realized that, and I was like, holy shit. So there's a lot in this movie that is just like, it's so meticulously detailed in the kind of foreshadowing, that kind of thing. And so that's part of the reason why I want to see it again. There's so much more stuff. From what I read this online, but apparently Elizabeth Moss's character like references the fact that she had plastic surgery early on in the movie, right? Or on her face at some point. And then when you actually see her doppelganger, there's a scar on her doppelganger's face. In the spot where like she pointed to when she said she had plastic surgery,
and I
didn't notice that when I watched the movie. So like I think that's a pretty cool like attention to detail type thing.
That's amazing. I know there's a scene when she like is looking in the mirror and cuts herself with the scissors, and I was like, oh yeah, that's like the plastic surgery, I guess. I didn't notice the scar, which like, duh. But I loved that. Elizabeth Moss's doppelganger like physically can't speak, even though, and her real like above ground character never stops talking. but like I loved that moment because like it's you don't notice it, like she's just creepy and weird. And then there's this moment where she like hears her husband screaming outside, like while Winston Duke is killing it or whatever.
Yes,
and she like goes to the window and like mouths screaming, and like there's just no sound. And I was like, oh my God, like it just gave me the shivers. It was crazy.
Yes. And I do love like in that sequence, right? Like the, when you, like you've watched Lupita Nyong'o and her family, like struggle like individually to survive and fight off the family, like that home invasion where you think like the home invasion is going to be the entire movie. Right.
Yeah.
And then you cut over to, Elizabeth Moss and Tim Heidecker after like a half hour of watching just that home invasion.
Oh, just sheer terror.
Of that stuff. And then you cut over to Elizabeth Moss and Tim Heidecker, and they're, like, in the middle of this comedy bit. And Elizabeth Moss is like, thinks she hears something outside, and she asks Tim to go look, and he's like, ah, I'm not going to look. Play the Beach Boys, Ophelia.
Yeah.
And so, like, the Alexa goes off, and it's, like, she starts playing Good Vibrations. And, you know, they're just kind of doing this comedy bit or whatever, and then they the two daughters come out, and then their doppelgangers come out. And, like, when their doppelgangers walked out, like, I realized this movie was about to go insane. Because I was... because that's the point where you realize, oh, this isn't just happening to Lupita Nyong'o. This is happening to everybody.
Right.
Because if it's happening to them and it's happening to Elizabeth Moss and Tim Heidecker, then like logically, it's happening to everyone out there. So their doppelgangers come out, and they like that family just immediately gets killed.
Yeah.
And it's I think pretty hilarious. Like it's a really effective scary scene, but also like after you've watched Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke and their whole family like struggle and survive, and Winston Duke manages to kill one of them, and they get out, and like it's all this thing, and then like that family just like immediately dies.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty great.
Yeah, they become the fodder. And I loved it. Like, and the twin daughters are so creepy, like just in general. Yeah.
The doppelganger twin daughters, or the regular twin daughters?
Both. The regular twin daughters is what I was thinking. Which I saw, I think slashfilm.com has an article kind of breaking it down, which, like, that evokes The Shining, obviously, which I didn't think of because I'm fucking dumb.
But yeah, the twin daughters were great. And yeah, the Elizabeth Moss doppelganger is pretty fantastic. I love, there's that one moment where she starts, like, kind of messing around with Elizabeth Moss's makeup kit. And, like, her lipstick, and she's kind of like trying to like put it on, and like it's like she's like trying to test out like the above ground life for herself or some kind of thing. Like there's a lot going on there. But then like they capture Lupita Nyong'o, right? They capture Adelaide or the tethered red or whoever you want to describe it. She's like, but there's like this, I feel like in that scene, there's this moment of recognition that Elizabeth Moss has with that Lupita Nyong'o where I think she realizes that she is actually one of the tethered, too.
That was the end of that scene. Yes, I agree. Like, there's a weird, like, they don't kill her. They just kind of like handcuff her and let her like survive or be. But there's a moment at the end of that sequence when they've killed all the tethered versions of Elizabeth Moss family, and they go out in the car and they need the key. So Lupita Nyong'o comes back inside and like they're not dead yet, and she kills them with the scissors. and she moves the, like, her physical, like, actual physical movements are reminiscent of the way the Tethered move. Like,
ooh,
it's
interesting.
It's very robotic, like, you know, quick, jagged movements. And it's like the sun comes back in and catches, like, sees her doing it. And she, like, there's this moment, there's, like, this one beat where she, like, throws the scissors away. Like, oh, you know, I wasn't holding them. And, I, yeah. like, that was the first time it got to me. It was like, did they get switched? Like, is this the real? Like, I, like, you know, that's why you, I feel like this is, has to be a scene a second time to understand, yes. like, all the references or clues that have been left for us to realize beforehand, maybe. But yeah, I love that, that, like, you know, the meticulous attention to detail like that.
And I mean, and that's the thing at the end too. It seems like Jason, the kid, realizes at the very end of the movie, like, that she's not like he, I think he really like, I mean, she's been his mom his entire life.
Right.
But I think he realizes at the end that she was one of the Tethered. Right. It's, yeah. It seems like there's that look in his face and there's that, that, like, it just, it's played very ambiguously. You don't exactly know what's going on, but, like, it seems like he knows.
Yeah, he knows something's different. Because at that point, yes. You know, Lupita Nyong'o, or Red, kills Adelaide, whichever way you want to put it, right? Yeah. Like, and she lets out this, like, primal scream, which sounds like the sort of sounds that, you know, Winston Duke's Tethered and, like, all the other Tethereds have been making. It sounds very close to it. And I was like, what the fuck is going, like, what's happening? And then and then she finds the son, and he keeps one of the rabbits for some reason, which, like, I loved that, because, like, sure. Yeah, I think he knew. I think he figured it out. And they, like, they share, they sort of share that, like, half smile. Or she gives him that half smile, and he puts the mask on, just like his Tethered had the mask on.
Yes, and I think that's part of it, too, because, I mean, if you think about it, like, she was the one who was living this life, and so she was Tethered, but, I mean, Winston Duke's obviously a human, but, like, the kids would be, like, half Tethered, half human. Right, that they would have, like, some of that DNA in them too.
Yeah, I don't know if it even would be that scientific.
Yeah, maybe not. But, like, I think, like, there's some stuff in the kids' behavior throughout the movie that is reminiscent of the Tethered in some way. I think the way they're, like, immediately ready for battle when they go into Tim Heidecker and Elizabeth Moss's house, I think, is a little bit reminiscent of the Tethered. And by the way, that whole sequence, I mean, you start with the Good Vibrations and you'll drop, right?
Right.
Where, and then that's when the when, like, the family gets killed and all that stuff. That's great. And then, she, like, there's this great moment where Elizabeth Moss tells Ophelia, or the Alexa, to call the police, but it mishears her and it says, playing Fuck the Police by N.W.A.
Yeah.
And then it starts playing Fuck the Police, and it's awesome, because it's a great needle drop, too, and it's a very funny moment. But then it follows that up with a sequence where Zora and Jason are going through the house, and it's all done in one take, of them, like, walking through the house while the entirety of Fuck the Police plays as they're, like, you know, preparing to kill these doppelgangers, too.
Yeah.
And it's just so cool. It's probably my favorite sequence in the movie, honestly.
Yeah, and, like, what a fucking statement that is, right? Like,
right.
The police don't save you in this moment. It's the two African-American kids are going to come fucking save the day, basically, in that moment.
Right.
Yeah, it's great. That was so cool.
Yes. All right. Is there anything else about us that you wanted to mention, Mike, or should we start to wrap this up?
No, I think that's really it. There's just, it's too much. I can't wait to read all the, like, dissertations and doctorate papers and shit that come out about this movie next year or later this year.
So yeah, I mean, I think we both really enjoyed Us, and I think we really got to see it a second time in order to really process a lot of it.
Yeah.
So whatever our rambling is worth for this episode, you know, I think we got to a lot of good stuff, but, I think next week, like, we should just take, like, part of our discussion time and just, like, if we both get the chance to see it again this weekend, for the next episode, we should just take some of our discussion time and talk about Us again.
I mean, I'm in, like, sure.
But we'll see what happens. We'll see how that plays out. But also, I did want to kind of just briefly mention one scene that I thought was very funny, which is the scene right after all that stuff in the in Tim Heidecker and Elizabeth Moss's house, where they're in the car, and Zora wants to drive, and she's like, "No, you're not driving." It's like, "I have the highest kill count in the family," and they're starting arguing about who has killed the most Tethereds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a pretty funny moment. I did like that. And Winston Duke's like, "You know what? I killed two. I killed myself, and I killed Tim Heidecker." And so I, yeah. But yeah, so good stuff. Us. Really enjoyed it. I'm not sure. Do you think this is a better or worse movie than Get Out? Just not that the two of them can even, like, really be compared, but just, like, throwing it out there. Like, if you had to watch one right now, what would it be?
I think, given the fact that I'm about to see Us in 2 days again, I'm gonna go with Us.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I really appreciate how much more cerebral Us is to Get Out. And it's just I really enjoy just like being challenged by this movie.
I think Get Out is a more clear cut movie, and it is exactly what it sets out to be. And I think Us is a little bit messier. But I really don't know. I would have to rewatch them both. And I think I might rewatch them both within the next few days, if I can. If my Marvel movie marathon doesn't get in the way.
Yeah, of, if you're allowed to.
If I'm allowed to. If I can break away from the chains of Disney for for 2 hours, Mike.
That's all we're asking, Mike.
That's all we ask. Anyway, so Us, we really enjoyed it, and we definitely want to see it again. And that about wraps up for this week's episode of Film Bookcast. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog. On Twitter.
And you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter and all our podcast stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. Don't forget to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to contact us, hit us up at MikeAndMikeGoToTheMovies@gmail.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a review of the new DC movie that seems to say, like, hey, maybe DC movies are fun now.
Maybe.
What a novel concept, right? And that is Shazam, which opens in theaters on April 5th. But they did have a early Fandango screening or whatever in like 1,200 theaters across the U.S. And I know at least one person who went to that, which I mentioned before. Kyle went. He said it was very good. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we'll be discussing The Runner, which is a political thriller that Nicolas Cage made in 2015, where he plays a politician in the midst of a cheating scandal while also dealing with the BP oil spill, I guess? Not sure what one has to do with the other, but we'll find out when we talk to The Runner next week. We'll see what that's all about. Thanks so much for listening, guys. We are out.
Mike and Mike go to the